Across Australia, you're listening to ABC Radio National.
Good morning, this is AM, I'm Peter Cave. The North Korean television has beamed pictures out to the world of the body of the country's late leader Kim Jong-il lying in state in a glass coffin surrounded by white chrysanthemums and red flowers it said were Kim Jong-ilia. Amid scenes of crying soldiers and workers, the television showed the son and heir Kim Jong-un paying his respects. The television said the great successor was a spiritual pillar and a lighthouse of hope, another leader sent from heaven. Like most foreign media, our correspondent Stephen McDonnell is not being allowed into the Hermit Kingdom and is following events from South Korea. Stephen, we've had the first appearance of the great successor. What happened?
Police turn up to see his father's body lying in state, the same place that his grandfather is at Kim Il-sung's mausoleum. This seems to be the order of the day, people filing in to see the body of Kim Jong-il in the big glass case with the somber band music playing. And that will be the scene of most of attention in the run-up to the more big-picture funeral ceremonies that will be happening more towards the end of these 2 weeks of official mourning.
How much comment has there been where you are in South Korea about the failure of the intelligence services to pick up on what was happening?
Well, this is pretty interesting. I mean, you know, you never really know what spies know or should be expected to know about these things, but South Korea, at least some people in South Korea, have been quite critical of the intelligence services here that they didn't know for several days that Kim Jong-il was dead. The reason that this is significant is because people are scratching their heads going, what is going to happen next? And I suppose one thing that you can probably be pretty sure of is that there won't be any massive turbulence, at least during this 2 week period of mourning, because you wouldn't expect the North Korean military or some sort of hot-headed general over there to be spoiling this somber occasion. So they're going to be kind of on their best behaviour, as it were, at least until the main funeral service of Kim Jong-il is over.
How critical will China's role be in the coming weeks and months?
Well, if anyone did know that Kim Jong-il was dead in that little two-day period, it would have been China. China's main ruler, President Hu Jintao, personally visited the embassy in Beijing to offer his condolences. But another crucial piece of news was that China's foreign minister, Yang Jiechi, got on the telephone with both his South Korean counterpart, Kim Sung-hwan, and also United States Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, so that China, South Korea and the US could agree on the importance of stability and peace in the Korean Peninsula. So those who'd be worried about a more broad conflict developing from this time of uncertainty would at least see that as a good sign.
And a sign of unification from the unification minister as well.
Yes, well, that's right. South Korean government, again, in something of a rare olive branch, given the way relations have been more recently. Unification Minister Yoo-wik said that his government hoped that North Korea would be stabilised as soon as possible and offered even his government's official sympathy to North Korea. So signs there that South Korea really doesn't want to upset the North at this time and provoke an increasing of tensions. In another small token, they've also decided not to put up these Christmas lights along the demilitarized zone. Now, this had been planned, and North Korea was quite upset about this, being an officially atheist country. They saw this as psychological warfare. And the South has decided not to dress up these trees as like Christmas trees with Christmas lights. There's a sort of a sign of goodwill to its northern neighbour.
Stephen McDonnell in Seoul. To Washington now, and a last-minute bipartisan Senate deal to extend a payroll tax break into the new year has been blocked by House Republicans. The high-stakes move has led to another end-of-year stare-down between the US president and conservative Republicans. And it comes just as new polls suggest that public opinion may be shifting back Barack Obama's way. Our correspondent Craig McMurtry is following events in Washington. Craig, I understand the president interrupted his own White House briefing today. What did he have to say?
Well, the interruption may or may not have been deliberate. We, of course, have no way of knowing. It certainly made the occasion more dramatic. The situation here is that Republicans divided themselves this time. Senate Republicans sided with Democrats on this payroll tax compromise. House Republicans say that the two-month extension that's been agreed on is simply unworkable. President Obama, when he came in, accused House Republicans of attaching other unrelated things to this bill. And as you can hear, he accuses them of playing political games.
I saw today that one of the House Republicans referred to what they're doing as, quote, high-stakes poker. He's right about the stakes, but this is not poker. This is not a game. This shouldn't be politics as usual. Right now, the recovery is fragile, but it is moving in the right direction. Our failure to do this could have effects not just on families, but on the economy as a whole.
President Barack Obama there. Craig, what's the Republican leadership position on all of this?
Well, they arranged a press conference. Speaker John Boehner appeared there, backed by a number of House Republicans. He says it's now up to the president to pressure Senate Democrats to return to Washington. They have already left the U.S. Capitol to go home for Christmas. Senate Democrats and the leader, Harry Reid, are saying they will not be returning. The speaker's problem here, the Republican speaker's problem, is that dozens of his own side in the Senate actually voted for this compromise, and there is a suggestion that John Boehner may have been rolled in this by conservative Republicans still concerned about the budget deficit, who are simply refusing to extend this tax break without more concession. So the question now is, who gets the political blame for a January 1 tax hike that could cost 160 million Americans $1,000?
Well, there are new polls out today which show the president is on the way back. What do they say about the White House's strategy?
Well, the Washington Post ABC poll shows that Barack Obama's approval rating is up to 49%. It's the highest since March, increasing from the low 40s by comparison. It has approval for Republicans in Congress at just 20%. More worryingly for Republicans, perhaps, it shows there's 50% of those who responded trust Barack Obama to protect the middle class versus only 35% support for Republicans. So the White House strategy here is that they hope the economy is turning, that the populist message that Barack Obama has been relaying lately is working for them, and that this time, at the end of the year, House Republicans may be overplaying their hand.
Craig McMurtry, live on the line from Washington. The last American soldiers from Iraq are barely back on home soil, and already the country's facing a risk of a new conflict. Iraqi authorities have issued an arrest warrant for the vice president, alleging he ordered the assassinations of government officials. Because of the fragile makeup of Iraq's government, where power is shared between Shiite and Sunni Muslims and Kurds, there are fears the scandal could fuel a new round of sectarian attacks. Middle East correspondent Anne Barker reports.
Just 2 days after US troops left Iraq for good, the country is mired in a political crisis that some fear could spark a new sectarian war. Iraq's vice president and top Sunni Muslim, Tariq al-Hashimi, stands accused of running a hit squad to assassinate key figures within the Shia-led government. The charges were made by Iraq's interior ministry, which comes under the control of the Shiite prime minister and al-Hashimi's longtime rival, Nouri al-Maliki. The vice president has accused al-Maliki of waging a campaign of persecution. All the efforts that have been exerted to reach national reconciliation and to unite Iraq are now gone. So yes, I blame al-Maliki. Iraqi authorities issued a warrant for Tariq al-Hashimi's arrest on Monday. State television broadcast what it claimed were videotaped confessions of three of his bodyguards who said the vice president had ordered them to commit murder. None of the men's identities could be independently verified, but they said they'd been given firearms and roadside bombs to kill Iraqi government figures and security officers, and that they'd been paid to do so. The first mission was in 2009, says one of the men on camera. The secretary of Tariq al-Hashimi's office at the Green Zone, who is his son-in-law, Ahmed Khatam, asked me to come to the office and told me that I'm reliable, honest, and because I worked in his office for a long time, he chose me to do dangerous missions. Al-Hashimi insists these so-called confessions are false and denies he's ever done anything wrong. The whole affair now threatens to destroy Iraq's fragile power-sharing deal between Shiite, Sunni and Kurdish blocs. It took the best part of last year for them to form a supposedly united government so soon after the years of sectarian warfare that pushed Iraq to the brink of a civil war. Iraq's former Prime Minister Iyad Alawi says Nouri al-Maliki is clearly the wrong man to lead the country. Tariq al-Hashimi is still in Kurdistan, the semi-autonomous region in northern Iraq, where so far he's been out of reach of the government's arrest warrant. But he says he's ready to face trial before an independent court in Kurdistan. This is Anne Barker reporting for AM.
And you're listening to AM around Australia on ABC Radio National, where it's 20 minutes past 7. The British tabloid editor turned CNN chat show host Piers Morgan has appeared at the UK inquiry into press standards. Morgan says he doesn't think that phone hacking took place at the Daily Mirror when he was at the helm, but he's defended other news-gathering practices that the public may consider unsavoury. Meanwhile, seven people have settled their legal claims over phone hacking with the now-defunct tabloid The News of the World. Europe correspondent Rachel Brown reports.
Overnight, Piers Morgan got his own taste of unwanted attention.
This has gone how I thought it would, which is it becomes like almost like a rock star having an album brought out from his back catalogue of all his worst ever hits. And I do feel still very proud of a lot of the very good stuff that both The Mirror and The News of the World did in my tenure as editor.
Mr Morgan became The News of the World's youngest editor, taking the reins at 28 years old. He's told the Leveson Inquiry via video link from the US he doesn't think phone hacking happened during his tenure. But he says other news-gathering methods, like stakeouts and rummaging through people's garbage, may not be edifying, but they're necessary. He told Lord Justice Leveson about Benji the Bin Man.
Benji the Bin Man used to live in a house that had hundreds, if not thousands, of rubbish bins. I mean, he lived in a sea of rubbish bins. It's a very unusual way to lead your life. Did I think he was doing anything illegal? No. If you throw something away, you're discarding it. And so you clearly have no more use for it. And it's going to go off to a rubbish tip where everyone knows people can walk down to rubbish tips and help themselves. Yes. So it's
I'm not sure they can, actually, Mr Morgan.
You can't go to rubbish tips?
No, I don't think you can, Mr Morgan.
Robert JQC asked how Mr Morgan had heard a private voicemail message left by Sir Paul McCartney for his then-wife, Heather Mills. It was after a fight, and the former Beatles singer crooned, "We can work it out."
You didn't think that was unethical?
Well, it depends on the circumstances in which you're listening to it. I can't go into the details of this without compromising a source, and I'm not going to do that.
Lord Justice Leveson grew exasperated.
Well, I am perfectly happy to call Lady McCartney to give evidence as to whether she authorised you to listen to her voicemails.
Mr Morgan was asked about his 2007 comment that phone hacking spread further than the jailed royal reporter Clive Goodman, but he says he was just regurgitating rumours.
I mean, it was exploding around Fleet Street. I wasn't there, I hadn't been there for 3 years, but everyone you talked to said that he was being made a scapegoat. This was a widely prevalent thing.
Also overnight, News International has paid out what it describes as appropriate sums to seven people caught up in the News of the World phone hacking scandal. They include Princess Diana's former lover, James Hewitt, and Paul Dadge, who helped survivors of London's 2005 bombings. This is Rachel Brown in London reporting for AM.
The former Immigration Minister, Philip Ruddock, says the government's Malaysia deal for asylum seekers could work if it agreed to some key changes. Both parties say they support offshore processing for asylum claims, but they're locked into a stalemate over which country should be used. Mr Ruddock says the coalition's concerns with Malaysia could be addressed, but temporary protection visas and a willingness to turn the boats back when it's safe must also be part of the government's strategy. He backs his party's refusal, however, to negotiate with the Immigration Minister Chris Bowen unless he presents a formal proposal for compromise. Mr Ruddock spoke to Louise Yaxley in Canberra.
My view is that all of the measures that we have proposed that were used by the Howard government need to be utilised now if we're going to turn this tap off and... At the moment, you've got an extraordinary large number of people, very much larger than we had to deal with. seeking to access Australia through people smugglers, and you need to use all of the weapons in your armoury if you're going to be able to deal with it. If you use then offshore processing, it does mean you have a better chance of getting more robust decision-making without the Australian jurisprudence coming into play, which makes it more difficult to get sound decisions.
Is there an ideal third country? The government wants Malaysia. The coalition says that Nauru worked. How do you get around that?
Well, the point about Malaysia is that the way in which the government announced it, it's very unlikely to work. My view is that smugglers could work their way around it very easily. If you know that the measure will only work with 800 people being returned for the 4,000, I think that Labor is going to take from Malaysia, those numbers would soon be dwarfed by the numbers that smugglers have already brought to Australia since those announcements were made.
So if Malaysia was to be used, then you're suggesting that the basis of the deal needs to change?
I think the only way in which it would work if it was open-ended, I mean, that's clear. Malaysia was turned down by the High Court as a proposed solution. They made it clear that because the arrangements were informal, and that's how they were described, that people would not be returned to situations of persecution, that didn't meet the provisions of the Migration Act. We've said that that could be addressed by essentially Malaysia becoming a party to the Refugee Convention. But I would suggest that it could also be met if Malaysia were prepared to formalise the arrangements, that is, to give Australia a written agreement that those people who were returned there, if refugees, would not be returned to situations of persecution, would not, in the words of the Refugee Convention, be refooled. You know, I mean, there is a degree of flexibility if they were prepared to take that opportunity. That's the only point I was making.
The Liberal MP, former Immigration Minister Philip Ruddock, speaking to Louise Yaxley. A study by the Australian Academy of Science shows that Australian high school students have abandoned science in a big way in the last couple of decades. There's already evidence that the declining appetite for science is having a negative impact, and there's no sign that the downward trend will end. Australia's chief scientist has told AM the trend may put the future of prosperity of the nation at risk. He says it needs to be addressed. Simon Lauder reports.
20 years ago, 94% of Year 11 and 12 students were enrolled in science subjects. Last year, that figure had dropped to 51%. The figures come from the Federal Education Department, and they've been examined in a study by the Australian Academy of Science. The lead author of the study, Professor Dennis Goodrum, says Australia's place has slipped in a global comparison of the scientific literacy of students.
I mean, Australia is doing well, but we're not doing this quite as well as we once did, and other countries are overtaking us.
Professor Goodrum says there's no sign that science is about to return to popularity.
There's no evidence that the trend has stopped going down. There's evidence that the decrease is slowing, but one can't interpret that to say that it's troughed at this point in time.
The Academy of Science has found the subject has been attracting students who see it as a way to get into university, and the curriculum has become crowded and dry. The president of the Australian Science Teachers Association, Anna Davis, says the new national curriculum will have to engage students at a younger age.
We've got to have the students doing the science, not just being spectators on the side. And the report suggests that there is still a lot of copying of notes.
The study was commissioned by Australia's chief scientist, Professor Ian Chubb. Professor Chubb says all Australians should be concerned by what's happening.
Well, I think they should be alarmed that there's a decline, whatever the numbers might be. And I think, the reality for us as an Australian community is when you look at the challenge that face us and our place in the world, then a lot of them are going to require science at the core of their solution.
The report makes 8 recommendations, including reducing the content of science subjects to a realistic level and providing ongoing training for science teachers.
Simon Lauder reporting. To finance now, and Wall Street has rebounded from its lowest level in a month after signs the US housing market is stabilising. European markets were stronger after business confidence in Germany rose unexpectedly. In New York, the Dow has bounced well back, 338 points up at the moment, 12,104. The Nasdaq is up 80 points, the FTSE in London is up 55 points, the Australian dollar back above parity, 100.61 US cents, up 0.71 on yesterday. I'm Peter Cave, that's the program for today.